welcome again to another edition of Lost in Science. This is half an hour on the radio where we talk about science, but this week we are out of time to talk science. So we're going to go back in time to talk about a little bit more science fiction. This is a compilation of stories from the past Lost in Science fiction episodes of years gone by, some of them as much as 10 years old, actually, when Chris is talking about Star Wars Episode 7, when we still all had great hopes for the resurrection of that franchise. What has Chris got to say about the science presented in Star Wars, and is any of it possible or real or feasible, and could we look at it through a telescope if it is far, far away in a galaxy? Also on the show, I am going to go back to 2001, A Space Odyssey, and look at how that film influenced the real science that has come after it. And Claire is going to give a review and discussion of the movie Ad Astra, which came out some years ago, all the way back in 2019, if you can even remember back that far. So that's what we have in store for you on the show this week. Please stay tuned. And beware, there may be spoilers ahead.
Quiet, Chewie. Okay, yes, that is the sound of a Wookiee you hear there, and we are well into Star Wars territory. Yes. Shut up, Stu. I really will bend your Wookiee. Okay, yes, we're talking Star Wars today, most particularly the upcoming film Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens, which it is to be fair to say we don't really know that much about because it hasn't come out yet. So, we can speculate.
Totally.
We can theorize, hypothesize, as we might be, because we're scientists. Look, we know some things about it, and we can be guided by what we've seen in posters. And we can refer to Wikipedia, which is the Star Wars version of Wikipedia. But we can also go from the title, which I believe is called The Force Awakens, and we can surmise that there is going to be some force action in this.
And some sort of awakening,
some
description.
Yeah. So the question is, what is the Force? What is the science of the Force?
Oh, the science of the Force.
I always thought the Force was a great concept in the film until they made the prequels and they went, oh, it's these little things that live in your cells.
I would defend those, but not right now. Let's go into actually what the Force actually is.
Okay.
And we'll quote from the expert. I won't do the voice, but life creates it, makes it grow. Its energy surrounds us and binds us. Luminous beings are we, not this crude matter. You must feel the force around you, here, between you, me, the tree, the rock, everywhere, yes, even between the land and the ship. That was, of course...
Was that Yoda?
Yeah, Yoda. Even between the land and the ship. Yes, that was Yoda from The Empire Strikes Back. You can see why I didn't do the whole thing in that voice.
Now, one thing I have to say is, the rock, how is the rock alive?
Well, you know, Obi-Wan also said it binds the whole galaxy together. So it's some sort of, it lifts up non-material things as well. Well, this is the point, is that, clearly it's meant to be some sort of mystical, spiritual type thing.
Yeah.
So maybe it is outside the bounds of science. But,
or is it just a subatomic force or something?
Well, this is what I want to explore. I want to look at the properties of this said force. Because, look, the idea of there being this sort of invisible force, mysteriously pervading all of the universe, isn't obviously foreign to physics.
No.
I mean, there's gravity and there's electromagnetic forces.
Exactly.
A lot of forces are invisible.
Exactly. Now, I've been reading a bit lately, too much lately about Isaac Newton, and of course, famous developer of the theory of gravity and the inverse square law and this kind of thing.
Crazy maths guy.
He was a bit crazy. He was also an alchemist. There is a book about him called The Last Sorcerer, and it basically claims that it's sort of the idea of this invisible force acting at a distance was something that came from kind of his Newton's magical sort of background, because a lot of people favoured the idea of a mechanical universe, and one of them was René Descartes, who had this notion that there were these kind of this ether everywhere that was filled with these vortices, and they kind of linked together like gears, and that's what kind of clockwork kept the universe going.
Sort of connected things to each other.
Yeah, whereas the idea of something mystically acting at a great distance without anything in between didn't make sense to people. But you know, Newton suggested that. Even though he wasn't quite sure, he still wanted to know how it worked. You know, he was able to come up with this idea of this action at a distance. And eventually, of course, you know, we've gotten used to this idea that you don't need an ether. There are these fields of force that are everywhere. And as you said, it's not only gravity, it's electromagnetism. Yeah, it's kind of all around us. We have a bit of a better idea now. We have like quantum physics and things, how it actually works. But still, this idea of the invisible force is not that foreign to us. But these forces do have certain properties, the most notable which, of course, being that they diminish over distance. The inverse square law, as you'd be familiar with gravity. So if you imagine, say, the Earth with lines of gravitational field radiating out of it, or radiating into it, I suppose it would be, it's gravity. You know, and you draw a sphere around that, you'd have so many sort of lines of this field cutting that sphere, and then if you double the size of the sphere, you still get the same kind of lines coming out, but the surface area will be four times as big. So that means the density of these field lines, the strength of the force, is decreasing with the inverse square of the distance from the source of the force. Yes, whereas you don't see this with the Star Wars force. It just seems to be...
Yeah, where's the source of the Star Wars force?
Well, it doesn't seem to be diminished over great distances. You know, when Darth Vader is talking to his mates over the video, his subordinates over a video conference in Empire Strikes Back.
He can choke one of them.
Yeah, like that.
And they're on a ship at the other side of the galaxy somewhere.
That's right. Obi-Wan Kenobi can instantly feel when the planet Alderaan is destroyed. And in fact, you can actually even use the force to predict the future, to see into the future. So it doesn't seem to have this kind of distance, and also time, it doesn't seem to be affected by either. You know, normal forces like electromagnetism and gravity, any disturbance goes at the speed of light, whereas the force seems to be instantaneous.
So is it an extra-dimensional force, perhaps?
Well, now, this is an interesting possibility. So it's definitely not electromagnetism or gravity, and it's not the other two forces, because there are four fundamental forces in our universe, and the others being the strong nuclear force and the weak nuclear force, which, as the name suggests, only act in the nucleus. But yeah, there could be forces in other dimensions. So superstring theory, which a lot of people think of as a theory of everything that will explain everything, does act in more dimensions than the four that we see in our universe. And we're just kind of a curled up sub-part of that. So yeah, there could be these higher dimensions and forces act in higher dimensions. Star Wars also makes use of hyperspace for their faster-than-light travel, which could be a higher dimension. So it's maybe that there are these other forces that are in these high dimensions that are acting through.
And hyperspace is what happens when all the stars just turn into lines and the Millennium Falcon goes
exactly. There's another possibility that was brought up in a book called The Science of Star Wars by astrophysicist Jean Kavalos, and she suggested that it could be this thing called quantum potential, which comes out of the theories of physicist David Bohm. This is a way of looking at quantum mechanics. So quantum mechanics is this weird kind of non-locality where things act at a distance instantaneously, or seem to at least. And this way David Bohm came up with the idea that there was this sort of other quantum force that acted between them and caused this non-locality. And that could explain these instantaneous effects of the force, although it probably won't allow you to lift up spaceships and shoot lightning at your fingers. So look, it's not terribly scientific. It doesn't really match up with science, but there is some possibilities there.
Well, and they even do mention at one point, although we never see evidence of it, is there's one point where they say, no ship that small has a cloaking device. Now, none of the ships in Star Wars have a cloaking device, so why they even mention it, I don't know. But a cloaking device could be a multidimensional thing as
look,
well.
Look, it could be.
And what about when it comes to the good side of the Force and the dark side of the Force? Or the light side of the force.
Most of the actual physical forces are morally ambivalent.
Amoral?
There's not a good version of gravity and an evil version of gravity.
No, there isn't.
Yeah, right. So falls down a little bit there.
Look, only one other thing I think I will mention about the upcoming film. One thing that I thought about was this whole idea of being a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. I think we can expect that will be at the beginning of this film as well. Now, some people have asked the question, if it is a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, would we be able to watch it for real with strong enough telescopes? Now, the most violent explosion in the original trilogy was the destruction of the planet Alderaan. And it has been calculated, an astrophysicist has calculated, that the power of that explosion would be about 10 billionth that of a supernova. So it's actually not that bright. And we could probably only see if it was in very close galaxy, like the one of the Magellanic Clouds. So maybe not a galaxy far, far away. However, the recently released posters for Star Wars Episode 7 show this modified planet that the bad guys apparently got.
Oh,
called,
yeah, I saw
yeah,
that.
It's
yeah.
called the Starkiller Base.
Whoa, and is that like implies, the Death Star on steroids?
Yeah, it implies that it actually blows up stars. So if that can create supernovas, then it's quite possible we could see the explosion of that in a galaxy far, far away. So it may be that we will be able to watch the events of Star Wars happen in real time.
Congratulations on your discovery, which may well prove to be among the most significant in the history of science.
I cannot accept half-baked theories that sell newspapers. I'm a scientist.
Who are you? Who are so wise in the ways of science?
A most distinguished scientist whose name we know.
I'm talking about even in the 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Across Australia Stanley on the Kubrick Community Radio Network, the you name, are listening to Lost in
pretty
Science.
Visionary director and made a whole lot of interesting sort of groundbreaking films in various genres. He didn't sort of stick to sci-fi. He was all over the place.
This was quite an early film for him, though, in his catalogue.
Yeah, yeah, in his career. He actually did a lot of technical pioneering in filmmaking too. He developed special lenses, for example, that allowed him to shoot scenes in the low light of candles. So he made a film called Barry Lyndon, and he wanted to be able to film by candlelight, and there was no such lens in the world, so he just invented one.
And he also filmed this film in 70mm film, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is much, much wider than you would normally see on film. It was
absolutely,
like,
it was, yeah, it was really high standard, but, you know, that's because he wanted to make it look amazing. So he wrote a letter to science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke after discovering they had a mutual friend. Supposedly they were talking about telescopes. And he used that as an excuse to Arthur C. Clarke a letter. And he proposed collaborating on a screenplay for what he called, what Kubrick called, the proverbial really good science fiction movie, which he insisted had never been made. And to be fair, there was a lot of...
Yeah, if you look at the predecessors, I think, was it that same year or the year before was like Forbidden Planet?
Yeah.
Which is like a kind of a hokey looking thing with a guy in a robot suit going,
But yeah, a lot of that sort of 1950s stuff.
Very kitsch, very
Yeah. And he just didn't want to do that. So the film itself is fantastical in a lot of ways. The discovery of alien artifacts and the suggestion that Homo sapiens were influenced by alien intelligence are basically pure fiction. There's no real reason to believe any of that sort of thing. But the rest of the film, the actual look of the film and the way it's presented sticks to what was at the time pretty good science in a lot of ways.
So film starts with early man in the desert banging on bones, and then in the background it's just a bunch of tape ears. There's just tape ears everywhere.
Yeah.
Just,
is that true to fact?
A lot of tape ears in those days. A lot of tape ears.
And some kind of wildcat. That's pretty much it. That's the whole wildlife of that part of Africa. So, look, the idea that aliens have visited Earth is the stuff of many more low-budget invasion movies, both before and after 2001 was released. But the response of the scientists who make the discovery is pretty rational. They don't panic and they don't sort of get the army out or anything like that. They're really curious. And though in the film version of the year 2001, the Cold War is still going on. So this film was made in 1968. So it was pretty tense at the time. But in the film year of 2001, the Cold War is still going on. So there's still sort of some tension. The Russian scientists are sort of suspicious of what the American scientists have discovered and all this sort of thing. But the lasting influence of the film itself is not just in cinema. Obviously, if you look at the special effects in this film, they were groundbreaking. They pretty much influenced every sci-fi movie that came after it. There was a lot of realism, which had been lacking.
There was also like a lot of good treatment of the whole issue of gravity and weightlessness, which you still don't get today in many science fiction films.
Yeah, well, that's it. If you look at something like Star Trek, they just walk around in deep space just as if they've got normal Earth gravity.
Yeah.
And they've got some in-story explanation for that, but it doesn't really make a lot of sense.
Yeah, yeah. Even that movie where they had to restart the sun, what was that one called?
Sunshine.
Yeah. And apparently they had, like, physics consultants on that, and they talked about doing a, you know, proper anti-gravity, but the filmmakers just went, nah, too hard. There's just anti-gravity. There's just, like, artificial gravity when you're inside the spaceship.
Whereas, yeah, in 2001 they have this, the ship has got a spinning section which allows them to
have centrifugal or centripetal force, I guess it is, making them be able to run around. It's a really amazing shot too when he's running, doing his jogging. And look, up until CGI became the most common way to make spaceships, this model making sort of stuff that they kind of pioneered in 2001 was everywhere after this film came out.
Do you remember the scene in 2001 where the scientist is on the flight to the moon and he lets go of his pen and then the pen just floats in air?
Yeah.
Do you know how they got that shot?
Yeah, I think they stuck the pen to a piece of plastic.
Piece of glass. Yeah. And then like moved it around like that in three dimensions so it looked like woo.
But I mean, you know,
and it looked incredible.
How did they do the space baby?
Well, they got this real baby and they stuck it to a sheet of glass. The interesting thing is that there's only a very limited number of special effects in 2001 compared to stuff like Star Wars, which came out almost 10 years later, which had hundreds more special effects thrown in. Although I have to admit, when I upgraded my old DVD copy to a new Blu-ray version, some of the sets in the early part of the film do look a lot more stagey on the high definition. Yeah.
That's on you, Stu.
Well, yeah, look, maybe I was just watching it on an old VHS tape at one point or something like that.
But how do the ape costumes hold up?
No, they're still pretty good. But the technology in the film itself also had an influence on the real world in a number of ways. By introducing concepts that kind of hadn't been thought about before. So the tablet computer revolution has ties to devices used in this film. Mm-hmm. The film was even mentioned in court when Apple tried to claim that they invented the tablet computer. They invented the iPad, and the people that they were trying to prevent from making their own tablets said, yeah, well, we watched this movie in 1968, and that's where we got the idea from, not from your machine. Obviously. Obviously, the ones in the film didn't work. They were just props. So, you know, to make an actual working one is a bit of a jump in technology. But, you know, the concept itself is what made people think of doing this in the first place. Another idea that caught people's imagination was the idea of artificial intelligence. In the film, it's represented by a supercomputer who accompanies the astronauts on their mission to Jupiter and basically controls all of the functions of their ship. So if you kind of think of that in terms of AI helpers like Apple's Siri, or Samsung has one called Bixby, and there's a bunch of other different ones. Alexa is another one.
Cortana.
But they're all influenced by Hal's manner in the film. And if you ask Siri to open the pod bay doors, she responds that she can't do that. But yeah, so the idea that the AI can actually take everything over is a bit crazy. The laws of robotics and that sort of thing, you can't really confuse an AI to the point where it'll go on a murderous binge.
Yeah, but there's like an alien artifact out there. Who knows?
That is true.
And, you know, Hal was putting the mission before the astronauts, right?
The mission first.
It was like a programming error.
Yeah. Well, he was supposedly given conflicting instructions. Although it is tricky to figure that out from just watching the film, I've got to say. Now, in terms of real space travel, the use of AI and robotics has probably moved away from human-led missions to other planets. We don't tend to chuck people in rockets and shoot them off into various directions. We send robots instead. So the chances of, you know, having your astronaut crew killed by the robot is pretty slim if there's no humans on board to begin with. But I think probably the main influence of the film is in inspiring people to get interested in space travel and science and all of those sorts of things. The Odyssey mission to Mars was named for this film, and it was launched in 2001 and went into orbit around Mars in 2001, and it's still there. So, you know, that's sort of all the people who were working on that got together and said, hey, let's call it Odyssey because in honor of this movie. But I think, you know, we're still a way off having space hotels and moon bases, but the parts of the film that have come true are in some ways so familiar we probably don't even notice them anymore.
I think we're lost.
We're not lost.
Not even any short-range radio signals yet?
Except for a single, very powerful radio emission.
Of course, a transmitter of that sort isn't exactly standard equipment.
The science and technology must be absolutely mind-boggling.
Of course, that's mostly on the theoretical side.
What so far? Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you're listening to Lost in Science.
Okay, Halloweeners. So to celebrate the 50-year moon landing this year, there have been some killer moon films. First Man, don't know if you saw that.
I didn't actually catch that one.
With Ryan Gosling as Neil Armstrong.
Mm.
That was quite good. And there was a documentary, Apollo 11. See that? No? Okay. Both were very insightful and honest portrayals of the moon landing in 1969. Honest being, you know, we didn't actually land on the moon. Right. Jokes, lols. Anyway, but, you know, this is lost in science fiction, not lost in moon landing documentary speculative history films. So today I'm going to be taking us down the road of one of the moon space science fiction films to come out this year. Specifically, the film Ad Astra. Have either of you seen it? No?
No, I haven't caught that one.
You haven't caught that one?
No.
Well, Ad Astra is actually Latin for to the stars.
Yeah.
So you know it's going to be good, right?
Yeah.
You know, reaching for the stars.
Oh, my God, it's full of stars.
So if you haven't seen it, it's just imagine a really brooding, soft-talking Brad Pitt who can't get his heart rate over, I think, 90 beats a minute or 80 beats a minute or something like that.
Or the
bus will explode. So all the he's like an extremely calm person. And anyway, this is like an Apocalypse Now sort of Heart of Darkness feel trip.
Okay.
But instead of going down a river, they're going to the end of the solar system. And instead of Marlon Brando at the end with his like, you know, big...
Nor.
Nor. Quiet talking Marlon Brando, you've got Tommy Lee Jones at the edge of the solar system with an antimatter device as well.
Wow.
Also, just for everybody listening, there will be spoilers in this. I may have already made a few spoilers. I'm really sorry.
It, yeah. Yeah, I think we should put a blanket spoiler alert.
Yeah, exactly. So in this film, we see Brad Pitt. He traverses the solar system. He makes it up as he goes along. He's almost hitchhiking from one spacecraft to the next. We see him get to the moon on a Virgin Galactic flight. Then he scrapes onto a flight to Mars after a chase sequence with moon pirates in moon buggies, which is a pretty awesome scene.
So it's a moon buggy chase.
It's a moon buggy chase.
Wow.
With pirates. Moon pirates.
With pirates.
Yes.
It's got everything.
It's got everything. I mean, it only lasts for a couple of minutes, but it does. He stows away on a rocket from Mars. He makes it past Uranus all the way to Neptune. Thanks, Chris, for that one laugh. So, yeah, some pretty cool things happen in Ad Astra. But one of the more unusual, unexpected scenes in the film is a particularly horror-filled, dramatic scene where Brad Pitt's ship, on the way out from the moon, the ship receives a distress call from another ship and they decide to check out what's going on. So the ship's captain and Brad Pitt dock with this other ship and head in. Turns out, you know, very suspenseful. There's no humans around. Where did everyone go? What's going on? Anyway, then they sort of turn a corner, as is often the case, with a suspenseful film, and they come face to face with giant, super strong, zero gravity space baboons.
That's pretty scary.
pretty scary.
It's like they're not moon baboons.
They're orbiting moon baboons. Yeah.
So they're what?
They're orbiting the moon baboon.
Okay.
All right. I'm sorry, I didn't call you a baboon. They're just orbiting the moon baboons.
Baboons in the moons.
Baboons in the moons. Anyway, these space baboons, they're angry and they eat the face off the captain. Like literally.
Ow.
Ow. Yeah. Yeah. Real ow. Real ouchy. So, yeah, look, I was quite shocked by the inclusion of a moon orbiting baboon.
A murderous moon orbiting baboon.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, seeing a monkey in zero gravity trying to kill everything, it's a pretty ridiculous sight to behold.
Mm.
So, you know, I got to thinking, how likely is this sort of thing, you know, monkeys turning murderous in space?
We ask the important questions.
We ask the important questions, especially on Lost in Science Fiction. So, this is what I do know. Monkeys and apes have been sent to space.
Yeah.
Yep. The Americans did it in the 60s, the French did it, the Soviets were doing it all the way up to the 90s, and Iran actually sent a primate into space in 2007. So we're not just talking like your long-tailed macaques either. We're talking some high-level apes. So,
well, you wouldn't want to send them. They might get its tail stuck in the door. It's a long-tailed macaque.
Or the short-tailed macaques as well, you know. I mean, any of the macaque family. We're not just talking, you know, small little little primates.
Chimp size and
there were chimpanzees that were sent into space. Ham, the chimpanzee, spent time on a suborbital rocket in 1961, where after that he returned back to Earth and lived in a zoo until he was 26 years old. So, yeah, there is a precedent for simians in space anyway, apart from humans. You know, monkeys, apes, they have been in there. But back to the murderous nature of monkeys in Ad Astra. What could drive them to become so murderous? Maybe they were genetically modified before they left. Maybe they caught a virus. But one of the main issues, one of the biggest things when you're sending living things, living organisms into space is the radiation. So when you're in space, you're exposed more to solar cosmic rays. And these can cause mutations, and over time, these mutations, you know, they could perhaps change the monkey behavior, they could make them really sick, or they could just cause them to get really, really angry. Hence, these monkeys could become murderous. Or maybe they were just really hungry. I don't know.
Yeah, could be.
Could be.
So the thing with the monkey doesn't crash back onto the moon and all the mad monkeys escape and become a planet of the apes. Is that's not the ending of the movie?
It isn't the ending of the movie, but maybe you need to do some fan fiction there.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's a great idea. So luckily we do have in place an international animal welfare agreement for space-borne research. So any payloads or any experiments that go up into orbit and go into space around animals have to go through an ethics committee. So at least that's something, that's some sort of check and balance to make sure that when we start heading back to the moon again, our time there won't be cut short by homicidal monkeys.
And that is all we have time for this week on Lost in Science. Thank you for joining us in Getting Lost. If you have any questions or suggestions for the team, get in touch with us by email. We are lostinsci@gmail.com. You can send cheap tweets to us at lostinscience1 on Twitter, or you can find us on the ubiquitous Facebook. Lost in Science is recorded at the studios of 3CR in Melbourne on the land of the Kulin Nation and is broadcast across Australia on the Community Radio Network with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find a podcast version of the show on 3cr.org.au, or you can tune in the way you did this week when we return in our usual time slot to get
Lost in Science!
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.